Welcome. Welcome, everyone, to the Fastest Known podcast, talking, as always, with some of the fastest people in our sport today. Wow. Today, I don't think we could say speed was what took place, but an extraordinary level of determination on one of the all-time classic routes in the United States. And today, I am speaking with Pavel Shafruga from Fruta, Colorado, who this summer thru-hiked the famous Colorado 14ers. That means he did all 58 summits, not only self-powered, but he walked to all of them, self-supported, did not get in a car. My gosh, let's figure out how he did this. Welcome, Pavel.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, again, the 14ers, that they're very competitive. We've had a lot of fastest known time of the year awards for the Colorado 14ers. They've been pretty competitive. And as I mentioned, normally people get driven to the trailhead. They hike up a 14er as fast as they can, come back down, get driven to the next one. And a few people extended the game by bicycling to doing the whole thing. But you took it to another level. You started, wow, I'm still wrapping my mind around this. You started on July 14th at Pikes Peak, hiked up Pikes Peak, and then kept walking, only walking, until 43 days later, you did Long's Peak, returned to the trailhead. You hiked the whole darn thing. So what's up, Pablo? Just give us your impressions, or just help us out. Help us wrap our mind around this.
Oh, well, yeah. I guess I didn't popularize it too much before. I mean, the joke was you got to walk the walk before you talk the talk. And this has kind of been on my mind for a few years. And I think I knew from previous endeavors that I was better at kind of grinding away slowly than trying to set some speed records in like a much shorter time frame. So this sort of lent itself, I think, to more of my skill set. And it just seemed like a good time. And I had been struggling with some knee issues, and it just kind of felt like they were getting better. And I was just going to go for it now because I didn't know when the next time I might feel healthy would be. So,
wow. Okay, so you started this while struggling with some knee issues, or you had a little break in that. That doesn't sound like the best way to start a 43-day trip. But you just felt it was time. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think I struggle a bit with just, you know, year after year goes by and I find myself working a lot, and I could get the time off right now. I had kind of scheduled it off, so I thought I might as well just start, and if my knee, you know, has a big hiccup, then I'll just come off the trail, but I might as well just give it a shot now and see what happens. So,
dang. Wow. Well, it's so funny because, you know, we have a wide variety of people on the podcast, some of the literally fastest runners, some of the most determined, and some of the most toughest people. And I really like what I'm hearing here. It was just work. You know, you had life, as we say, was taking up a lot of time, and it was sort of a now or never thing. But gosh, all 58 self-propelled on foot. Here's another quick technical question. So self-propelled, you had no support, obviously, no outside support, and you walked into grocery stores whenever you could. Did you ever mail yourself food, or have your girlfriend mail you food along the way?
No, the only thing I had mailed to me was when I got to Aspen. I had ordered a pair of shoes from REI that got delivered to another store there that let me do that because no one in Aspen seemed to carry the shoes I wanted. So that was the only like outside support I got other than stuff I picked up along the way. So
you had a pair of shoes delivered.
Yep. And then in Telluride, I also bought another. I went through three pairs of shoes, but so in Telluride, I had my second pair. And that was from Jagged Edge. So I just bought them there. So,
well, this is what we would call a very pure style. So to walk through this, pardon the pun, you started with, you know, let's see. If you started in Manitou Springs, you didn't need that much food because you'd be going through Woodland Park and stuff like that. So you would just look on the map, decide when the next town was, and carry that amount of food. And then when you got to town, you just walk into the grocery store and buy what you needed for the next section. And probably you walked into a restaurant and chowed down. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I ate a lot at every town stop I could. I had this all pre-planned though. So, I mean, honestly, a lot of it felt pretty brainless. I had, you know, the Caltopo app, and I felt like I was just following a little green line a lot. And I had all my grocery stores marked, and, you know, people would ask me, did you just come off this pass? Like, how was it up there? And I'd be like, I actually have no idea. I've just been following this line for days, you know? So, yeah, I think I had it all pre-planned, and at each grocery store, I had marked kind of how many miles I needed to the next place. And if the terrain seemed tougher, I'd, you know, buffer an extra day or two in case, you know, with the weather forecast, if I thought I might get held up. So
that's good. I'm glad to hear that, because that's how I would have done it too. And that's how the good through hikers are doing it. It's a very high degree of pre-planning. So Caltopo enables one to self-generate maps using amazingly good data that Caltopo's loaded up for free. And then did you navigate with Caltopo, or did you download the GPX files into Gaia?
I actually ended up navigating with Caltopo. I was more familiar with Gaia before this trip, but I just had so much off-trail travel. And for some reason, I was getting this hiccup where it would try to, like, I'm not sure what they use, like stick my route to the existing route. And that sometimes would be like, no, like I need to be on this ridge that's, you know, as the bird flies, an eighth of a mile from the trail in the valley, but it would like try to sticky me to that lower trail. And I just got too frustrated with that and ended up trying out Caltopo, and it didn't seem to have that hiccup. So, it was snapping. That's the word. Yeah, I was snapping my trails to stuff I didn't want. But I would say previously I'd loved Gaia, and my girlfriend actually still uses it. So we have both subscriptions. So,
well, this is good for people to hear. So anyone planning their 43-day trip, we get helpful advice, or one-day trips. So Caltopo and Gaia always were the 1-2 punch, but now both platforms, I'm just going to add this little bit of information, both platforms have broadened their feature set. So usage is always use Caltopo to do the map creation and then do all the navigation with Gaia. But now Gaia allows mapping, as a mapping feature, and Caltopo as a navigation feature. So they're both one-stop shopping now. So thank you for filling us in that you liked Caltopo. Just unbelievably good technology for almost no money.
Oh yeah. And like with all the slope angle shading was super helpful. And and then I even got the, I think, premium subscription so I can get that satellite data that's just a few days old, which, you know, isn't too high resolution, but really did help to know that I wasn't going to be facing a lot of snow. So,
right.
Yeah.
No, again, thank you for describing this, because the listeners, you know, they like to be informed. They like to learn. And so both these apps have current snowpack levels. I mean, you could buy via satellite, which is just absurdly good. Wildfire. It's not just like 15-year-old USGS maps. The information you get could be uploaded within the week. So yeah. Thanks for filling us in. So going way back, Flying Brian Robinson, the first person to thru-hike the Calendar Triple Crown, the Appalachian Trail, Continental Divide Trail, Pacific Crest Trail in 1 year, he really opened my eyes about pre-planning. And these guys are thru-hikers are great planners. And indeed, when ultra runners tend to go out and do these long trails, they tend to flail. They fail. The hikers tend to do better for anything longer than a week. And in my opinion, it's because of what you just described, your planning. A runner is going to tend to rely on their speed and say, oh, I can just do this. This isn't that far. Well, you pre-planned it. You were following, like you said, the little blue dot. That meant you could just keep moving. Am I hearing this correctly?
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, totally. And I would, you know, I did have a Garmin InReach, so I'd use that for weather, and I'd text my girlfriend sometimes to look into weather for me as well. Yeah, basically just staying on the path and looking at the weather was kind of the only two like outside things I relied on, you know. So,
wow, this is a great story. So let me ask you before we leave this part behind, how much time did you spend planning it?
Lots. Well, lots within like a 3-month window. There was definitely a point, like I shuffled all the sections around. I originally wanted to finish in the Elks because it's kind of like where I cut my teeth with a lot of my bigger days, and it just would have felt nice to kind of finish at home, you could say. But it ended up, it was going to cost me like 80 miles, you know, which would have been 2 to 3 days. And so this path was almost the most efficient one I found. I think it would have been more efficient. There was one more efficient way, which would have been to go from Pikes to Longs and then essentially do the thing backwards. I couldn't find a way to get from Pikes Peak to Longs Peak that wasn't just walking the highway the entire time. So I think I took like the 40 mile hit because I just didn't want to do that. So
understood. But
yeah. No, but I would say like within 3 months, I was probably putting in more time on this than my actual work, which wasn't good. So yeah. But
it's understandable. But it paid off. Again, so the listeners can grok this, you average 27 miles per day. And that's, of course, carrying all your own food, all your own water. This is everything. This is purely self-supported. And this requires finding the food that you need along the way with no support. 27 miles, that's over a marathon per day with everything on your back. And that also means a total, apparently, this is shocking, of 297,497 vertical feet, almost 300,000 vertical feet again. So I think pre-planning was time well spent. I mean, you don't want to be going wandering around the state of Colorado with that type of mileage and that type of vert at stake.
Yeah, well, and I mean, on that note, there is two guys that did this in the 80s. I'm not sure if you've read up on this. I couldn't find too much about it, but from my understanding, they were just hiking the Continental Divide Trail and then on a whim decided they should just do all the 14ers. And I think it took them 5 months, but I've often marveled at just how many less people and infrastructure there was in the state. You know, their navigation was paper maps. It was just been, that would have been an adventure. So
you, I could say, are the first, what should we say, modern era person to do it. So there's stories like you just told that are not recorded. We don't have them on our website, and I have never seen any mention of this. So in the modern era, we're counting you as the first, even though, like you say, you probably were not. That's why, by the way, we call it the fastest known time.
On your website, there is two guys that did it, I think, in 2013. And I think 72 days. And I actually wasn't aware of that when I started planning this, but eventually I, you know, came across that information. So.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for acknowledging that.
Yeah. I think, I think their story is maybe pretty well published on the internet too, if people are interested. And I think they took a bit more of a standard hiking approach, I think just with their setups and stuff. So.
Right. Well, now your background, Pavel, is, it's mixed. could I say that correctly? You've climbed 513, a very hard technical standard. I don't think you've been much of a runner. You've done big outings, like you said, in the elk range. So this seems like a big leap. Am I seeing this correctly? I mean, we haven't hiked the Appalachian Trail, and you didn't ever run the Leadville 100. So it's this seems like a strong, brilliant push.
Yeah. So I actually think I would, before like 2018, when I started having, 2018, I think when I started having knee issues, I would say, like, quote unquote, I would identify more as a runner than a hiker. I have ran like Portland Marathon and, I just started having knee issues and, but you know, through those things like the Elks, which I did right before, that was like a 35 hour push. I sort of felt like, you know, like no one is going to be, you know, I'm never going to win like something like the Leadville 100 or something. I just think it was too high of intensity and like a very, you know, a relatively short time frame. But you know, I've done a bit of backpacking, and then my sister actually just finished hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. So as part of the preparation, went out for about 10 days with her. I don't know. I it's weird, 'cause I think there's kind of this culture that like, if you're doing something, you should like throw it up on the internet. And, you know, since we've moved to Fruita, I would say every year I'll go out in the canyons here and, you know, have some little loop that's a challenge that will probably be, you know, like 25 to 40 miles. And, you know, it's just like my own little challenges. And I think some people are like, why isn't there more on the internet? I don't know. I just kind of like to, you know, I think this is kind of my magnum opus. So I felt like it was a good time to share it. But I think my other stuff, I'd rather just kind of keep private, and with my good friends, you know, we'll laugh about it over a beer, but you know, I'm not changing the world with it. So I just kind of keep it to myself. So.
Wow. That's quotable. I'm going to, I will use this. I like to keep private. I'm not changing the world with it. This is good, because there is this, what should we say? An interesting blow up of information on the internet, on social media specifically, right? Instagram, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm parsing my words carefully here, because I don't want to offend anyone, and I don't want to disavow anything that's really helpful, because there's good information. You want to know what your friends are doing. Well, at the same time, there can be, from my personal perspective, a little bit too much of we look at me. And it's like, okay, well, fine. You know, I'm not sure how helpful this is. Like you just said, you're not changing the world with it. And so you mainly do your projects on your own and talk about it with a few friends, but this is your biggie. And so you went public with this one.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on that. You know, I think, oh man, I should choose my words carefully too. No, you know, I think sometimes people are sort of addicted to the feeling of getting likes. Well, what they're putting out there is nothing special. Like, I mean, I'll have people who put pictures out of their breakfast. And I think, you know, if you took away that feeling of getting the likes, are you proud of it? Or is it swaying what you're doing? And I think by having these personal challenges that I don't expect to share with the world, I think it, you know, like, I think one of my personal sayings is like, what would you do if no one was watching? And I think, by being out in the mountains and knowing that no one's going to give you a participation medal or anything, you know, it keeps you honest. Like, if you don't want to be out there, you don't have to. And if you want to push yourself, then, you know, stay out there. And I think it's good to have just personal standards on that stuff and not be looking for some kind of validation later on. So,
okay. Pavel, this is good stuff. We appreciate this.
it's turning dark quickly.
Well, I started it and you just chimed in. So you are innocent here. And I will even take it one step further towards darkness, which is then we'll reel it back in toward the light, so to speak, which is there is a crisis in young people's mental health, and it has been associated with overconsumption of social media. When young people, as you said, become addicted to the likes, there gets to be this increasing peer pressure, which they're already susceptible to. And if they're looking around and everyone is, you know, skinny, happy, having fun, having sex whenever they want, it's like, wow, I'm doing terribly when they probably are not. So there is a little bit of a dark side to social media, and there is a terrific side to it as well. So let's just say, you know, be healthy with it, right?
Yep. Yep. And, you know, try to really reflect on what's really making you happy. And, you know, if someone took the social media aspect away, what would you be doing? And I think if people can stay honest with themselves, then I do think it, you know, it's a very uplifting space as well. So I'm not the person to say we should get rid of it all, but I think you're right. It is a very unhealthy thing for some people. So,
wow. Well, we're suitably impressed with through hiking the Colorado 14ers, and you did not do that by public support. I suspect that was inner driven, inner motivation. You did it because that's what you felt like doing. And you also mentioned that you had a little time off from work. And just to trend in that direction for a second, apparently you build custom camper vans. Am I correct?
Yep. I've got a one-man shop here, but I'll usually do about 4 to maybe 6 vans a year. And I just schedule the time block off. So,
and you do – so I presume people – buy the van and bring it to you. Do you do ProMaster, Transits, and Sprinters, or do you specialize in Dodge ProMaster?
I've done the most Sprinters and then probably ProMasters, and I've only done a couple of Ford Transits. So,
gotcha. Well, yeah. I will put this in the written show notes if that's okay, but you're going to get a few calls if I do that. Is that okay if you get a few calls?
Yeah. My website is horribly outdated. So, you should put some, if someone listens to it, don't expect the pricing that's there from like 4 years ago.
I see. So you're still in the just do it category. You're weak on marketing and strong on the construction end. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I actually don't know. I feel like all of my, you know, I'm mostly a rock climber, I would say. So my entire, I think, client base has been word of mouth in the climbing community. So I don't know if my website has actually ever done anything for me. So,
okay. Well, we'll put it in. Would this be the best? So if someone listening to this would like a custom build out of their van, your website would be the place to contact you. Is that correct? Because you can give, I'll put in whatever you want.
Yeah. Primevans.com. And I would, you know, if I had 20 seconds to sell myself, I would say I'm trying to kind of build in the same style as a lot of this like hiking mentality, which is, you know, efficient and super lightweight designs, but that's kind of a difficult thing to sell sometimes. You know, I'm not big on what I call like the ornaments on the outside of the vans. I just like, you know, quality, well put together interior, but anyways, that probably wasn't necessary. So,
Pavel, you are our guest. You can say anything you want. And I think Van, speaking of social media, you know, hashtag van life is huge. So all sorts of people are either in the process of or romanticizing having a camper van. It's funny, you know, because the whole Winnebago thing, that class is so out, you know, it's not really a thing. Even the trailers are kind of out. Camper vans are huge out west. Currently, yeah. I'm in Michigan, and they're not huge here. It's really interesting. In, you know, Colorado, Moab, it's like 10% of the vehicles on the 70 between Denver and Grand Junction are camper vans.
Yeah. It definitely seems like that. So.
Yeah, and you come east of Denver, the whole eastern half of the country, not so much. But at any rate, your website will be on the written show notes, so people can track you down if they'd like a custom build out. And I appreciate it. It's not a lot of, you're not going for lux, in other words. You're going for a place to eat, sleep, and cook. Is that correct?
Well, I would say my woodworking is actually probably, I don't want to sound pompous, but I think it's better than most of the van companies out there. And I think that's based on like material choices of just no particle board or any of that junk. But I think there's a big push in the market of vans to put these like giant bumpers and mud tires and these huge roof racks on them. And I mean, the vehicles are just too big to like truly off-road. And I think it's just cosmetic appeal that at the end of the day doesn't make your van safer and will probably eat like 5 to 8 miles per gallon off your efficiency, which from a lightweight backpacker's perspective, you know, it's pretty easy. It's like the same as watching someone carry in like a giant camp chair or something.
You know, wait, you should update your website. This is good stuff. I mean, right?
Yes, it's on the list. You know, it's like somewhere between 100 and 150, I think, in the priority list.
I like it. Yeah. See, this is worth it because I think people listening can identify that. You see these big rigs, and you know the four-wheel drive, you know, Sprinter, the Mercedes Sprinter is the only one that comes, I think, still the only one that comes in a four-wheel drive version.
And Transit's got an all-wheel drive, but yeah, I think it's it hasn't suffered from the same like eye candy bloat yet. So
I see. Well, there's still time for bloat. We, after all, are in America. So you're building out your camper vans like your backpacking style. So it's very, very functional, good quality, but clean and lightweight. So greater efficiency. Wow. Yep. Okay. We just helped you with your website marketing slogans.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll give you a commission if I hit it big. So.
Okay. Now, we've also been reported, this is great. We covered a little bit of social media essays and now a little bit of van build out. But you apparently were suffering a little bit from rhabdomyolysis when you finished, which means it is a kidney malfunction, which is not uncommon in ultra running, where one gets a little too dehydrated, the kidneys start to close down. This is what I hear. I don't know anything. So fill us in. I mean, what happened immediately after and how are you feeling now?
So immediately after, I actually finished close to 11 p.m. And I definitely had kind of a, you know, the weather forecast that day wasn't very good. But when I kind of reached this last saddle, at which point I could kind of set up camp and then make an early morning push, I had a pretty good weather window, it looked like. So I was kind of like, screw it, I'm finishing this. So I did end up getting hit by rain after I descended like the sketchy part, you could say, of Long's Peak. So it wasn't bad, but it was, you know, anyways, I got into the trailhead late. My girlfriend got there about 15 minutes later in the van. And that night things were great. I drank a couple beers. The next morning I went out and ate a gigantic breakfast. But when we got home, you know, on the other side of the state, when I took my socks off, like finally shower for the first time in a while, my feet looked, I mean, I jokingly say I looked like I was diabetic. So the first symptom was that I had this like horrid leg swelling. And about third day after that turned into like, I started getting these super violent cramps. Like when the first one hit, I was actually just pulling a car out of the driveway and I thought I could just drive through it, but I had to like pull over physically. It was just too intense. It was pretty crazy. I'd never gotten cramps like that. And that didn't go away. So right about a week after I finished, I finally went and got some blood work and I had more than my kidneys were a little off, but actually my liver values were, like my doctor, you know, he's actually an old friend from Washington who lives a little bit south of us. And, before he saw my results, he was like, I think this will just resolve and get well. But when he saw it, he was like, no drinking. You're looking pretty sick right now. Like we got to retest you in a week. So since then, I'm trending quite a bit better. Like there's like an indicator for rhabdomyolysis. And that's actually returned fairly close to normal. So I don't have any more like muscle breakdown, but my liver values are still pretty elevated. So I'll actually get retested again in about a week here, and hopefully I'll be back to normal. But since learning that my liver was doing poorly, I was not supposed to drink. I've had a couple beers because we did have a big fundraiser, et cetera. But, you know, anyway, so that's kind of been it. I think I'm returning to normal. My leg swelling has basically gone away. And at this point, I'm mostly feeling normal. It's just whether my liver is doing well or not, I'll find out in a week. So,
wow. You crossed the finish line, and that was that.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually wondered if I, you know, this is like my own speculations. I think, you know, you hear these stories of the body kind of adapting to stresses, and I pondered whether the same thing would have happened, like had I finished a week earlier, or I could have just kept going and my body would have, you know, continued to endure. But it was just, you know, once I just stopped, it was kind of ready to, you know, go into right. This state. I don't know. So,
right. Well, a little confusing on my end, which is Rob Doe is, I'm not a medical professional, but I believe it is a malfunction of the kidneys. You mentioned your liver values, which is something different. So how do you sort that out?
So I think I did read that. So from my understanding, is the most common form of rhabdo is actually with maybe like weightlifters or CrossFit people. So it's more, they have like a really intense day, and then they just eventually, they'll have this kidney problem. They go get sent to the emergency room. They'll get an IV to pump a bunch of fluids, because when the muscles get broken down, it releases some toxic protein or something. But I think my doctor did end up reading about, so there's more limited research on like what you would say like extreme endurance athletes or something, where their liver problems are not out of the scope of side effects from that. And so I think since mine wasn't the result of just like one harsh day, but this just constant degradation, I think it's less common, but it is totally feasible, I guess. So.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, you sound really good. So hopefully it's a short-term situation.
Yeah. And I definitely feel like physically I think the worst physical aspect right now is, you know, on like a humorous side of the story, when I took my rest day in Aspen, it was the first time I'd like seen myself in the mirror. And I told my girlfriend that I'd lost a lot of muscle. And when I got in the van at the very end, like before I even took my little down jacket off, she was like, "You've lost a lot of muscle." Cause you know, so right now climbing has been pretty rough. I would say I knew I would come back out of shape, but I am really out of shape right now. It's pretty humorous. So,
you're back to the 5'9" warmups.
Yes. It's yeah. And since we climb at a place called Rifle Mountain Park, mostly it's kind of known for harder routes. So it's been,
That's overhanging limestone.
Yep. Yep. So, and formerly a place that I loved, and now I am struggling.
So. Okay. Well, continuing with our theme of this podcast, which is really good, which you providing excellent information, I'm just going to trend in a slightly different direction here and ask, what food did you eat? And the context for this is, besides your subsequent issue here, a very slow recovery, losing a lot of muscle mass, an interesting study came out, I think it was this last winter, where a graduate student, and it's just coming off the top of my mind here, so I don't remember what university, it might have been John Hopkins, but it's an Eastern university, also through hiked the PCT trail. I'm sorry, he's a graduate student in biology. He was a medical student. I forgot which specific field. And they did a before and after study on himself. So this is pretty interesting stuff. And he became less healthy. Now you'd think that, you know, a big through hike, you're going to become much fitter, stronger, et cetera, et cetera. But he did not. And he ascribed it to poor diet. In other words, going back to flying Brian Robinson, I mean, he was not famous for, but he got up in the morning and put a bag of granola in his pocket and just ate granola dry out of his pocket, out of a plastic bag for breakfast. And then all day long, it was Snicker bars. And then his only hot meals were in the evening. You know, that's efficiency. That's how you move forward. Yeah. And that's not a great diet. So yeah. The efficient backpacking diet is not a good, healthy diet. So this is an interesting situation. So how do you, you're an intelligent, thoughtful person. So what did you eat? How do you relate to your loss of muscle mass? And I guess a third question, Pavel, is what would you do differently next time?
All right. So that study, I think, was interesting. I actually did read a little bit about that. And some of the parameters they measured was like how well the veins or something could contract and then expand. I forget what the name of this stuff was, but I did think it was pretty interesting. And I think it would, so I didn't have a stove, but it would be super hard to try to travel fast and eat healthy. And I think, you know, the body just craves carbs, fats, at least for me, you know, sugar. And I mean, to be honest, I joke that I am good at eating even before this. So, you know, some of the things that made me wonder about it is how was his diet before versus during the hike? And for me, I would say I try to eat healthy, but, you know, I'm not like one to pass up a donut if it appears in front of me, you know? So, I would say I started out eating, I would say generally the first half I didn't eat enough. I had kind of like this, super bad kind of energy bonk, kind of going through the collegiates where it was like one of the most depleted feelings I've ever had. But generally, you know, the start I ate a lot of like Snicker bars as well. And a lot of that was just kind of traveling through the San Luis Valley. There wasn't a whole lot of, you know, like once I got up into the mountain towns, there's outdoor shops. They've all got, you know, either energy bars and stuff. But when you're going more or less into Family Dollar, you know, they're going to have M&Ms and Snickers. But I would try to eat, I ate a ton of beef sticks and meat sticks, a lot of cheese sticks. I ended up burning out a bit on actually chocolate, which I'd never thought would happen. So I switched more to nut butters on the second half. And then I sort of burned out on tortillas. So I actually started just like crushing bagels down and making like tuna fish and cheese or meat stick and cheese bagels.
Well, in case anyone was thinking about repeating, having a go at it, I think you just talked them out of it. So good job here. People need to listen to this podcast in case they're thinking of going after your through hike of the 14ers. And after this section, they go, maybe not.
Well, you know, and then in town, if there was a restaurant or a diner, like I described it as I would eat a comical amount of food. Like I had a morning where I ate three breakfast sandwiches and a breakfast bagel. When I got into Leadville, like I first coffee shop I hit, I had a couple pastries because that's all, they didn't have any like breakfast food. And I knew I wanted to go to like Tennessee Cafe, I think it's called, because I'd had a burger there on a previous trip. But on the walk there, I ate ice cream at the burger place. I got a second basket of fries afterwards. And, you know, that was all within like a 5-hour window. So it was, I could definitely eat on that trip. So.
Wow. Well, this is good. This makes perfect sense, actually. I mean, it's not like you're going to go get kombucha tea at your local store in the middle of San Luis Valley. And of course, when you leave the San Luis Valley, you have to get to the next valley. So it's actually a serious walk right there. That's very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. So if someone, the classic through hiker style, just to go back to that for a second, for the speed walkers, that is to mail oneself drops. And so you mail yourself, you do this insane amount of pre-planning as you did, and you package in these little boxes, you know, a change of socks, then for once a month, a pair of shoes. And then literally the fast guys would do all their food. So they'll go into town and pick up their food box and not necessarily stop at a restaurant or a grocery store. And so they're eating their extremely limited diets that they prepackaged the previous winter, which might be better than, you know, cheese sticks that you're going to get at the gas station. That's very, very interesting stuff, isn't it? Like, you go through Aspen, great. Let's go have some sushi. But elsewhere, yeah, beef jerky, okay.
Yeah, and I would say that I think coming into this, I know that I can eat about anything. So I would say that that was the other benefit is I wasn't, you know, in retrospect, with the energy crash I had, it was clear that I had a couple 6-day carries there of food. Well, I knew there'd probably be like 4 to 5 days, but I needed to buffer with how the weather looked, that I could be stuck out there for a bit. And my pack is pretty small, so I don't know if I could have actually carried much more food, but I knew that like I could walk into a gas station and I could subside on gas station food. Whether physically that was a good idea, I wasn't, you know, allergic to anything. So I knew I could make it. So for me, it was pretty easy to avoid the mail drops. And I'm not sure. And then this is just totally like splitting hairs. I've often wondered how that, you know, if you're going to truly go in like a self-supported style, it just seems, you know, maybe the United States Postal Service has some delay function, but I didn't want someone to go, well, someone mailed you these packages. Like, how can you call that self-supported? So I just didn't want to entertain that idea either, just, you know, from a logistics standpoint. So.
Gotcha. No, that's good. Good knowledge. Good information. Again, the classic self-supported style is to mail drops, the speed self-supported style. And like you say, the more casual self-supported style, which you were not, but the more casual style is to hike in or hitchhike into town and buy food at stores and eat at a restaurant. But again, just to be clear, you did not do that. I believe you did not get in a car.
Yeah. Well, and I think that was partially, I mean, that just seems easier than doing something like the Pacific Crest Trail because, you know, I got to make my own path, which, I mean, that was part of the logistics would be like, I've got to end up at a place I can resupply. And even if you were doing mail drops, you know, there's probably a few more post offices than, you know, food sources along the way. But either way, like I had to get into towns. And since I was creating my own path, that was just one of the, you know, objectives, I guess you would say.
Right. This is very interesting. I'm glad we talked about food, besides being important anyway, for something like this that's critical. And this really separates out, this puts out a good exclamation point on your project, which is you self-supported. Yeah, it is officially self-supported, but barely. I mean, minimalist in that style. And unlike the AT, the PCT, the classic through hikes, where you're resupplying from towns, which aren't necessarily and usually are not directly on the trail, you walked your route, period. And yeah, that enabled you to create what that route is. So instead of, you know, trying to go stay on ridge lines, you know, you road walked into a town because you had to go to a town. But at the same time, that had a very purist style, didn't it? You walked your line and you walked every step of it.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, it's kind of a amazing feeling. I mean, my base weight, that's the term that is probably common on this podcast.
Yes.
Was only about 8.5 pounds and I had a helmet even. So, I mean, the feel, you know, I would watch these people, I would pass these people, you know, on the trail that probably were lugging like 40 pounds of, you know, stuff they picked up at REI the weekend before. And the feeling to just have this tiny pack that, you know, I could take through all sorts of terrain and at any point could just camp. I mean, it's like a sense, it's a great feeling in the mountains to not be really hindered by what you've got on your back. And at the same time, have the ability to just be out there for days. So,
wow. You just opened up a whole little area for me that I didn't think of. I knew you went light, but helmet, that's a little bit surprising. So you're walking down a highway with a helmet on your, but not a lot of other things. And you carry the helmet, of course, for rock fall. And being a rock climber, wearing a helmet is totally natural, and you should always do it. This is very interesting. I wonder, Pavel, if you should send us a gear list. Would you be willing to do that? And we'll put your gear list in the show notes, which you've never done before. But this sounds like it might be interesting to know about.
Yeah, I mean, I would quickly just say that, like, I slept in a bivy, and there was a pretty heavy monsoon period at the start of this for the first couple of weeks, and I really debated getting a tent. But I actually, you know, I kind of felt like the bivy kept me honest, because there was no option to just, like, hang out somewhere for a whole day while it rained. I mean, the way to basically stay warm was to keep moving. And, I don't know. So I think my setup, in some ways, I purposely made it minimal, because I didn't want the comfort, but I just wanted to, you know, I basically packed to keep moving. I didn't pack to camp in comfort. And, if I had had a partner with me, I think, you know, and it wasn't more of a social trip, I would not replicate that. So.
Indeed. Well, Joe Grant, when he did the self-powered 14ers on a bicycle, he didn't bring a foam pad. Maybe you didn't either. I don't know. But I would have brought a foam pad, because I would have slept a little better, and the 7 ounces would have been worth it to me. But a bivy, do you mean by a bivy, do you really mean there's no hoops to it at all? Or did it have one hoop for your face?
Oh, no. So I did have the Outdoor Research with the one hoop, and I actually did have an inflatable pad. And I've got about like a 30, 35 degree Western mountaineering bag. And my setup, which I think worked really well for me, is I just keep all three of them inside each other. Oh, I keep the sleeping bag and sleeping pad inside the bivy, because the super lightweight sleeping pads and sleeping bags, I mean, they can get torn on anything, it feels like. So
was it that Therm-a-Rest pad?
Yeah. And I actually did have one that started leaking. Anyways, this one, Telluride, I actually got a new one. But then my sleeping bag is like Western Mountaineering's platinum something. It's like their anniversary. You know, it after getting it overstuffed, it's still under a pound. So I just enjoyed that setup, which is every morning I would just stuff my bivy that had my sleeping pad and sleeping bag just in the bottom of my pack. And I felt like it added a good level of protection, and the whole thing just stayed assembled. So
more efficient.
Yeah. And I sure glad I didn't have a big explosion at down feather somewhere along the way. Cause you know, I think when you're trying to hurry, or when you're trying to pack your stuff as you're getting rained on, it's pretty easy to just move too fast and snag it on something. So.
Right. Well, I have the same pad, and I hear I do a lot in the desert, but I prepare that ground real carefully, because that's super that's thin material. That'll go flat just looking at it cross-eyed. So good job.
For sure. Yeah. And then my backpack is I have a 13-ounce pack made by a guy named Dan, who owns Dandy Packs. And I'd love to give him a shout-out. It's Dandee. I forget if he's from Massachusetts maybe, but he just makes custom one-off packs. And so, you know, I could – probably send a picture of my pack too. It's got a little slot for a helmet. And that thing was just amazing. It held up great. I purposely had like the bottom of it reinforced, because I knew I'd be doing a lot of like butt scooting coming down scrambles. And big huge shout out to him for making just a masterpiece of a pack. So
wow, this is I'm sorry, I'm just what are, you know, at one gear head to maybe another. It's an easy place to go and talk about, because when I was with Ultimate Direction, I intentionally had our industrial designer reinforce the bottom of all the packs for that same reason, the fast packs, because that's where it's going to break. I mean, you can have a pack that's perfectly fine, but the bottom is falling out from, you know, butt sliding down things. Yeah. So that's kind of, that's good stuff. If you wanted to send in your gear list, we would print it. Mm-hmm. That way Dandy Packs would be in the written show notes. And listeners, I can't guarantee this is going to happen, but right here on air live, you are requested to send in your gear list, and it will get printed on the written show notes.
Yep. I can get that to you probably just later today. So
Okay. All right. Wow. Yeah. This is so fun. I'm still surprised about, well, I have to ask you about the helmet. I presume it's because of your rock climber background. It felt natural and due to rock fall, but that meant 99.5% of the time you didn't need it. So help me out on the helmet choice.
So the helmet I use is like the lightest one. It's like 6 ounces is the Petzl.
6 ounce helmet? I didn't know it was a 6 ounce helmet.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, I'm not carrying some giant thing around. I think it's just, on a serious note, you know, we've lost some friends in the mountains. And just with how popular a lot of the 14ers are and all the rock fall up there. I don't know. It would have seemed like a dumb way to go down. And jokingly, like I would stuff my raincoat in it on the outside hiking a lot. And then if I would like pick up a nice pastry, I would joke that it would be like my Tupperware because it would keep it from getting crushed. but
multifunctional.
Yeah, for sure. It's an easy thing to bring, I think. And, I just kind of maybe a pact my girlfriend and I have that it's easy to bring. It's lightweight and I didn't test it out. I didn't get hit in the head again, which is good because the day I don't have a helmet and get hit in the head, I'll, you know, maybe not wake up. So that's it. I just think it's just the little personal pact that, it doesn't really inconvenience me and I'm sure keeps me safer.
Well, let's just use the word safe. I mean, as Andrew Skirka said, there's lightweight and there's stupid light. Where you're taking away things that you actually should have, and it doesn't do you any good to not have them. So good call, Pavel.
And I would say that on my route selection, coming from my climbing background, I did make some route choices that I wouldn't recommend to someone who isn't familiar with a lot of scrambling and such. So, you know, I didn't take probably on half the routes, half the peaks, there's some degree of non-standard route. And at that point, you know, you're just dealing with a lot more loose rock. People might not know that you're off on this ridge below him because most people don't travel that way. And so that lended itself to, I think, knowing that I would be in terrain that I think warranted it more than just taking all the standard routes.
Gotcha. So your route selection was based on your abilities as a rock climber. We should note that you didn't necessarily do the standard Colorado 14ers trail up. You took more of a direct, efficient line because you were technically capable of doing it.
Yep. And it is also like the terrain. You know, if I go out for a day, that's usually the terrain I'll seek too. I just think, you know, you don't have to do, you know, there's more solitude and, getting to do cool ridge lines versus like slogging up hills is just, you know, it just makes the terrain go by faster and it's great. I love it. So,
okay. I'm going to ask you a second to the last question.
Okay.
Which is, did you ever doubt it? Did you ever say, I don't got this? Did you ever feel like giving up?
Yeah. Certain moments, I got hit by one was on the way to Culebra. I got hit by a thunderstorm, but I was thankfully at this like veterans memorial. It had like a little picnic table with a cover above it. And I sat through this thunderstorm for like 6 hours under this cover. And that was a moment where I was like, my setup is not adequate. Like if I was in the mountains and this hit, like I don't think I'd die, but like my stuff would be floating away. I don't know what I'd be doing. And you know, thankfully the next day I woke up and there was like roads washed out. So I was like, okay, this can't be something that happens very frequently. And then coming into Telluride, I got hit by another thunderstorm where I kind of sat under this tiny little road cut that stuck out maybe a foot. And, you know, I usually, when I see the lightning strike, I start to count because they do that whole thing about how far away it is, you know, and I wouldn't even like, it was within like a second and a half that I would hear the, just a boom. And, you know, that's pretty humbling. And then I guess the last one was when I had just this complete energy crash on the way up Huron Peak. I mean, I don't know if I'd ever felt so fatigued, like walking downhill, I had real doubts about, what the next day would bring. And, you know, I had pretty limited food and I knew if I didn't make it to Aspen, I had enough food, but I just felt so depleted. I'd never crashed, I guess, that bad. The miracle of sleep, I mean, I woke up the next day and, my body pulled through, I guess. And that was pretty, that always amazed me how I could just get in my bivy, just completely trashed. And, a handful of hours later, like 6 to 8 hours later, wake up and somehow my body could do it again. That really amazed me. So.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. 43 days. That's huge, Pavel. That's huge. High altitude, long distances by yourself on sometimes technical terrain, 2 big thunderstorms and 1 energy bonk. Well, that's.
Well, those were the worst. I mean, my feet were, there was like the opening 2 weeks had a lot of monsoons, and I've got some, there's a photo of my feet on like one of those articles out there. And I think I kind of laughed. They actually published it because that's pretty disgusting. So.
Wow. Yeah. Well, all in all, not bad. And you hung it out there. Let's put it that way. Like you said, it's happened to me before too. You get this big storm event, which happens to come at a time where you're relatively protected. You think, wow, if I was where I was 2 hours ago or where I was about to be, this would not have gone well. And so you hung it out there and you did this.
Yeah.
And you were successful by being, I'm going to say this, by being smart and being very experienced. Sorry, I'm just going to call this out, since being a good athlete, you won't call yourself out, but you're very experienced. You're very skilled. And so people listening to this should recognize that you've built up a skill set and you did the proper planning and preparation to make this be successful.
Yeah. I think, I have a map of off my watch, and I kind of hesitate to just throw it on the internet because, like all the deaths on Capitol Peak, every year it seems like there's a couple more. And there was that one year, one really bad year a few years ago. I think they had 5 deaths. And I think a lot of that is you just put the tag on something and it's the hardest, and it just draws people that aren't prepared but want to get that, tick mark on their list. And so I struggle to like freely share all my routes with people that, you put the GPX file up and I can't give someone the caveat I think I shared a story about going up Windham Peak, which is usually a fairly casual mountain, but I went up it off the South Ridge and that was terrifying. I would never recommend someone repeat it. And I wouldn't even repeat it myself. But, if you throw that GPX file on the internet, someone might see it and never find that backstory. And, I just think that people should do their homework and take a honest assessment of what they're capable of. So,
well put, well said. My last question is our traditional last question, which is, what's next? Now, of course, considering what you've done, this is an offensive question. I hesitate to ask it, but we ask it every time. So if you want to say, don't ask me that, I just want to rest and make a few vans and make a little bit of money, that's a very good answer. So what's next can be answered any way you wish.
I definitely need to make a little money. But I'd like to, it's been closing in on like the end of my third year where I feel like my rock climbing hasn't improved at all. And a lot of I really like to feel like I'm moving forward with some part of my life. Whether that's climbing or, hiking like this. And I think my lack of progress in climbing between too much work and then injuries kind of like fueled my fire to get this done, in many ways. And, so currently I'm excited to go rock climbing again and get back in shape. And, if that goes well, it'll probably be few to many years before I'm kind of fired up for something of this caliber again. So
I can understand that.
Yeah.
Well, Pavel, I very much appreciate you. Thank you for spending your time with us, and what a great trip you have. You imparted a lot of information here.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having me on. So.
And anyone listening, if you enjoyed this, please subscribe. If you just went off this, subscribe. You can do it anywhere from iTunes to Spotify, elsewhere, and give us a good rating if you like, because good ratings help other people find the Fastest Known Podcast. Thanks, Pavel, and thanks everyone for listening.